Isaiah 6 says, "In the year King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord, high and exalted, seated on a throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphim, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying, and they were calling to one another, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory.' At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. 'Woe to me,' I cried, 'I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty.' Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, 'See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for.' Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send and who will go for us?' And I said, 'Here am I, send me.'" Isaiah has a Wizard of Oz experience. He encounters a great and powerful, fearful God. There's smoke and terror and awe. Last Sunday, we started a series on God, and it is a daunting task to even try to talk about him, much less understand him. In fact, the first thing we learned last week is God is beyond our understanding. It's like an ant trying to understand Einstein. Isaiah 40 says, "To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal?" says the Holy One. And the answer is no one. No one is his equal. No one can be compared to him. So how do you preach on or understand someone you can't compare to anything or who has no equal? And that's the task we are embarking upon in this series on God. And you might wonder, you know, this God stuff is kind of theological and a little philosophical, and what's it got to do with me? I'm going to go back to a real life tomorrow. Got to go back to work and got kids running around. What's this have to do with anything anyway? And I'm glad you asked. Here's the deal. Where there is a healthy view of God, there's a healthy view of life. So the whole premise of this series is, who is this God that we worship? Because the God we worship affects every aspect of our life. It affects our thinking. It affects our attitudes, our values. It affects our parenting, our attitude towards work and toward people, toward ourselves. And the more clear view we have of this God, the more clear view we're going to have of everything. And to be honest, we'll be better people. Now, the opposite is also true. Where there's a distorted view of God, there's also a distorted view of life. And I think that's all pretty relevant. This God will help in any anxiety. It will help in our love. It'll help in hope. I mean, it'll help in everything the more we get to know him. So the starting point, and we have to start here, is we will never, ever fathom fully this God. Our knowledge of him is a thimble full of water compared to the ocean. And the more we stand in awe of this God, and the more we understand how small we are compared to him, the more we will have a proper view of him and of life. So, I want to say, just starting this series has already affected me in some very positive ways. Isaiah says, "I saw the Lord." What did he see? He sees smoke. He sees seraphim, which are flying beings. He hears thunderous voices that shake the temple. But if you look for a description of God, there's not much there. All it says is the train of his robe filled the temple. Any vision of God in the Bible never really describes God. It describes things around him or things about him or things that convey truth about him. But God himself seems to be elusive, indescribable. And Isaiah is just dumbstruck. There's a scene at the start of the movie Jurassic Park, early part of the movie, where Alan Grant, who's a world-class paleontologist, and he's devoted his life to the study of dinosaurs, and he suddenly comes face-to-face with a real, live dinosaur. And he and the people with him, their mouth drops open, their eyes bug out. Alan himself staggers and falls to the ground speechless, you know, oh, you know. See, it's one thing to study dinosaurs and pick through fossils and bones and piece together an image of a dinosaur, and it's one thing to read about them, but to actually encounter a real dinosaur, something else. And that's Isaiah. Isaiah is a priest, and he's a prophet. He has studied God. He's a man of God. He knew about God. He preached about God. He learned about God. And that's one thing. But now he's actually encountering the living God. He says, "I saw the Lord." And that's a whole different thing than just studying him. And my hope for this series is that you will all encounter the living God in your life, and it will change things. I hope that you will not just hear about God or just learn about God, but that you will actually encounter him. Now, back to this text. Some of the implied characteristics of God that Isaiah encounters, I want you to get just a little feel for who he is, even though we cannot fully describe him. Seated on a throne signifies he's the sovereign king. Sovereignty is supreme power, supreme authority. He's sovereign over all. There is not one molecule running around in this universe that is free from his control. He is in control of everything. Every person is under his lordship. Psalm 15 says the Lord will reign forever and ever. Now, Isaiah was in a time of transition in the nation of Israel. Isaiah has died, it says in verse 1, and Isaiah had been the king for 52 years and was very good king. But now there's uncertainty. Assyria is coming in from the north. And so he sees the Lord and is seated on the throne. As a reminder, God is on the throne, not Isaiah, not Assyria, not Babylon. God is in control, not Russia, not China, not the United States. He is sovereign. He is the king seated on the throne, and that makes all the difference in your view of life. Another description is high and exalted. He's above us. There's no one like him. Isaiah 45 says, apart from me, there is no God. This is not an ordinary being. So now, some ways he's above us, he's self-existent. He has no origin. Children will sometimes ask, Mommy, where did God come from? Even adults ask that question. Preacher, where did God come from? And the answer is God did not come from. He's self-existent. And we struggle with that. We have this finite thinking of cause and effect that everything comes from something. Someone having no origin introduces an unfamiliar category. It contradicts our experience. Everything in existence has a cause except God. He is the uncaused cause, self-existent. Another way he's above us is self-sufficient. Again, we can't get this. God doesn't need anything. We, on the other hand, we're all dependent. Every creature has needs, but God needs nothing. God does not need food. He doesn't need water. He doesn't need air. He doesn't need Isaiah. He doesn't need you. He doesn't need me. He doesn't need this church or any church. He doesn't need this world. He doesn't need our love. He doesn't need our worship. He's self-sufficient. Now, he uses us and allows us to participate in his mission, but he doesn't need us. And sometimes, I don't think we quite get this. We have this idea that God is needy, maybe even codependent, and we'll damage him if we don't respond to him or worship him. You know, God's got this ego, and we got to keep building it up. It's just silly. Now, there's a picture that we've all seen, probably, we've all seen, of Jesus knocking at the door. And this is a biblical picture in the book of Revelation. Jesus is knocking on the door of a church at Laodicea. Let him in. But sometimes when we see this, we get it wrong. And it's almost the idea of, poor Jesus. See him out there in the cold, knocking to come in? It's so sad. Won't you let poor Jesus come in? If you don't let him come in, you'll hurt his feelings, or he might have to go away hungry. Are you really going to shut him out? And we think Jesus is this beggar trying to get in, and it's silly. Jesus doesn't need us to open the door. He doesn't need us at all. There's some people who get mad, and they quit on God. Well, God let me go, and God didn't answer my prayer, and they think they can punish God or get back at him or maybe hurt his feelings by, I'm not going to pray anymore, I'm not going to go to church anymore. God doesn't need our prayers. He doesn't need our church going. He is totally self-sufficient. We desperately need him. We desperately need his church. But he does not need us. Another way he's beyond us is eternal. Another concept we cannot grasp. God did not begin. Begin is a time word, and it is not applicable to him. Some people say the universe has existed something like 13.8 billion years. Some would say, no, it's much less. We don't know. However old it is, even if it's billions of years old, that would be a micro dot to God. This is just beyond my brain that he's eternal. We could go on and on. He's immutable, means he doesn't change. We do, he doesn't. He's omnipotent, means he's all-powerful. We are going to do a sermon on that. Omniscience, he's all-knowing. We're going to do one on that. Omnipresence, he's everywhere all the time. These are all concepts we cannot fully grasp. And those are concepts that make him above us and beyond us. And we have to start there. Third part of Isaiah's vision is fire and smoke, signifying mystery. The room is filled with smoke, and the word for seraphim literally are fiery ones. In the Bible, many visions of God have both fire and smoke, or one or the other. And the reason is that fire is one of the most unique, mysterious elements in our experience. Fire somehow translates mass into energy. I find fire fascinating. I can stare at a fire for a long time. It's kind of mesmerizing and hypnotizing. And even scientists who understand combustion still cannot fully explain fire. There's a mystery about it. For one thing, it's self-sustaining, like God is. Technically, I guess it's a high-temperature oxidation reaction. That still doesn't really explain it. Another thing about fire, besides being unexplainable, it's a source of great blessing. We're drawn to fire, and we need it for warmth and light. It provides energy. We cannot exist without it. Put out the fire of the sun, and we die. We need it. It's life-giving. But we know fire is also dangerous. It can burn, it can kill, and it's not easily controllable. It can destroy a great deal. Another thing about fire, I mean, it has a lot of quality. Another thing, it cleanses. Forest fires actually are necessary for cleansing and new growth. So fire has all these different, even contradictory properties about them, and they're all true. And I think it's not a mistake that God is often associated with fire, because he's a mystery that we don't understand. And we're drawn to God because he's warmth and light and blessing and life, and we need him. And yet God is also dangerous. Fire is not to be trifled with. And of course, God cleanses like fire does. But the central theme of this chapter and of the whole book of Isaiah are those three words, holy, holy, holy. He is distinctive. There is no one like him. He's eternal, we are not. He's self-sufficient, we are not. He's immutable, we are not. That's the kind of God we worship this morning. And to be honest, I don't want to worship a God that I fully understand. He wouldn't be worth worshiping. But because he is beyond us, he's worthy of our worship. Now, theologians make two lists when they describe God. If we can get that list up there, please. There we go. On one side is, on the left side there, is who only God is. No one else in all creation is infinite or incomprehensible or self-existent. And last week and this week, we've been focusing more on that left side, how God is above us and beyond us. The right side is what God is and we can be. God's truthful, well, we can be too. God's loving and just and good, we can be all those things as well. Not to the extent that he is, but we can have some of those. Now, who were the first two people? Adam and Eve. I knew you'd all get that one. Adam and Eve. Now, do you remember the temptation that serpent whispered to Eve? Eat of the tree and you will be like God. That was the lie. You humans can be like God. And that was the temptation, and that is the temptation to every one of us. We want to be like God, or even God himself. Now, we're not going to hit on all of these traits of God, but when we talk about that list on the left, even though these are true only of God, we will see that we want them to be true of us. We want to be, or sometimes we think we are in control. And sovereign, or powerful, or we want to be in the know. We want to know it all. Sometimes we are incomprehensible, but that's another story. We will see, as we go through this, how we try to supplant God by thinking or taking on these traits for ourselves. And Satan still tells the lie to all of us, you can be like God, those things on the left. So the right side is what we should embrace and be like God, justice, goodness, and mercy, but the left side is not for us, and that's when we get into trouble. So, two temptations, which are really two sides of the same coin. Last week, we talked about one temptation is to reduce God, make God into our image. Martin Luther said your God is too human. And the reason we do that is so we can control him. We want a God who agrees with us, and he doesn't interfere with what I do. If I let God be God and truly be Lord of my life, then he may ask me to do some things that I don't want to do, and I don't want to give up my control. He may ask me to forgive someone that I just don't want to forgive. He may ask me to change my attitude, and I really don't want to change it. He may ask me to obey my parents. See, the bottom line is we don't want someone else telling us what to do, and we don't trust God's goodness enough to let him call the shots, so we reduce him, a God who agrees with me. That's not a God worth worshiping. So we want a God who will provide but doesn't intrude, who protects but never demands, never judges, never meddles. We want a God who doesn't infringe on my life except when I need him. We want a God who saves me but let me live the way I want to live the rest of the time. See, your God is too human. And we all do it, including me. The other temptation, which is really the other side of the coin, is to exalt ourselves to God's status. We want to flip roles. I want to be sovereign and in control of my life. I want to have power. I want to call the shots. And both these temptations are simply attempts to displace God by either cutting him down to size or elevating ourselves. There are some aspects of God that are only God. And I hope we will grow in our reverence and awe and submission before this God. And once we just get a little glimpse more of who this God is, it will change your life and perspective on everything. Whenever we encounter him, it should bring about two reactions like Isaiah had. One is an awareness of our desperate shortcomings. Verse 5, he says, "Woe is me, I'm dead, I'm ruined. I'm unclean, I sin. But it's not just me. I live in the midst of unclean people. There's no one righteous, not one. We are all ruined. God is holy. We are unholy. We are rebels, and we deserve death. And if you can come and worship this God on Sunday morning and leave without any sense of shortcoming in your life, you have not encountered the biblical God. You cannot help but experience some weakness, some feebleness, or some failure if you encounter the true God. Arrogance has no place in the life of the Christian, none. Max Lucado says, imagine that you're in a theater and you've never visited one before and you're just curious, so you start poking around backstage to see how it all works and everything, and you see a dressing room there, and you go into the dressing room, you sit down at the table, and there's this mirror in front of you, and look at yourself in the mirror, and you know, you don't see anything different there than you usually see in a mirror, but then there's a switch on the wall, and you flip that switch, and all of a sudden a dozen lights come shining on your face, and suddenly you see things in your face that you hadn't seen before. Blemishes and wrinkles and moles and marks and zits, and the light has illuminated all those imperfections. And that's what happened to Isaiah. He comes into the light of God's holiness and he's shocked by what he sees in himself. The blemishes, he says, I'm ruined, I'm unclean, my people are unclean. See, the closer you get to God, the more you'll see your own blemishes. And that's good, because that's when the cleansing can happen. You know, I don't think I've ever said these words, but I hear a lot of people say them. I'm a good person. You stand in the presence of God, you would never say that. Now, there are times I wish I could have a vision like Isaiah did. Wouldn't that be cool if God would show up like this some Sunday? Don't you even think if there's time, if I saw God, my life would change too. I've never had an encounter like this, and I want to say, God, just show us your blazing glory. Show us yourself in the church right now. Give us this Wizard of Oz experience. Wouldn't that be cool? Isaiah would not say it was so cool. It was awful. I think God would say to us then, if you've not seen me and not seen my glory, it's because you've closed your eyes. In fact, verse 3, he says, the whole earth is full of his glory. God is all around us. He's here today. He's been here in the music and the word, in other people, in creation. God has shown himself. He has revealed himself. Many just don't look. Romans 1 says, God has been clearly seen so that no one is without excuse. The problem is most people don't want the real God. They may want an experience of God. They may want to be zapped. They maybe want to rush. But they don't really want God. Or if they do, they want a reduced, tame God. Now, in the Wizard of Oz, you remember later this wizard is revealed to be just a guy. Nothing powerful, not all-knowing. And I remember the first time when I was a kid, I saw that movie. I thought, oh, crud. That's the wizard? That's a senile old man who can't do much. So all he can say to the lion, lion, the courage you're looking for is within you. And same with the scarecrow and the tin man, you know, the heart and the brain, it's all within you. So what they're saying is you can find the answers within yourself. You hear what's going on? Self is the answer. Self is God. And that is maybe the number one heresy today. Self has replaced God. Self is omnipotent. You can do it.
self is omniscient. The answers are within you. Just look within. So God now is simply just a God of good advice and not much more. The real God isn't fire and storm and power. He's not all-knowing. The answers are not with him. The answer is within you. And that's the lie. You have the answers. In other words, you are God. Wizard of Oz, I hate to burst your bubble, is actually heresy. But that's what's happened to God in most people. God's been reduced, and I, self, has been exalted. God's been neutered, I've been empowered. I found this quote, I'm not even sure where it comes from. It says, a safe God neither inspires awe, nor worship, nor sacrifice. A safe God has no power to console us in grief or shake us from complacency or rescue us from the pit. He just putters in his garden, smiles benignly, waves now and then, and mostly spends a lot of time in his room doing puzzles. That's not what Isaiah saw. One of the seraphim takes the coal from the altar, touches the lips of the prophet, cleanses him, because fire cleanses, like God cleanses. And Isaiah's first response was his own devastation. I am ruined, and only an act of God can save him and cleanse him. But after God cleanses him, here's the second response from Isaiah that we need to have. I will do anything you ask. Here am I, send me. The goal of encountering God is not a spiritual experience. It is not so we can get a rush. The goal of worship is not to zap you or to make you feel good. The goal is submission. And that's what's transforming. When God reveals himself, four things will happen. Number one, we see him in all his glory, and his glory is all around us if we just open our eyes. And you get a new vision of God, a new sense of awe and amazement. Second thing that happened, you'll see yourself in all your frailty and desperation. You are ruined without this God. You are not okay. No one else is okay without this God. Third thing you'll see is your own cleansing, the grace coming to you. God wants to heal you if you'll just come through Jesus Christ. That's why he sent his son. And then the fourth thing, we turn ourselves back over to him completely, and it changes everything. That's the gospel. That's true worship. We see him, then we see ourselves, receive his grace, and then we offer ourselves. And notice, God does not have to ask for volunteers. He doesn't have to beg Isaiah to serve him. He doesn't need Isaiah. Isaiah begs God, let me serve you. A true worshiping church should never have volunteer shortages. I mean, how can anyone say no to this God and what he's done for us? How can we say no once we understand just a glimpse of him? Here am I. Send me. I'll go. I'll do whatever you want because now I've seen your glory. Would you stand up right now? I want you to read these words with me. These are from Isaiah 6, just some select words. Read this with me. Woe to me, I cried. I am ruined, for I am a person of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. And my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And I said, here am I, send me. Here am I, send me. Here am I, send me. Let's pray. Lord, we need to see you. And you're all around. Just open our eyes. And when we see you, we will see ourselves and our desperate need for you. And we will see that we are made in your image. And that image is special, but that image has also been scarred. We were made to worship you, but we are tempted to worship ourselves. So may we see you, at least get a glimpse of your glory, and may we receive the cleansing and a new life, a new perspective, and a new way.